Well, we're getting into some things that are so much the heart of Christianity that I find that I don't like to even get out of them. I love to just stay in them. And while we're in them, I hope that we'll enjoy them and we'll profit and benefit from them to the very utmost. When Jesus, in the midst of all of this talking about things that pertain to the heart, and that's what all this does pertain to, all of these, you see, are attitudes. Poverty of spirit, mourning, meekness, hungering for righteousness, mercy. All of these are attitudes of heart, really. And in the midst of all of these, though, he stops or includes in this listing one of these that actually mentions the name heart itself. Blessed are the pure in heart. So I think we're faced with a double importance, since we find that these are all attitudes of heart. For him to then come along and in the midst of all this lay one other one on us that actually mentions heart, I think we better stop and take double notice of it. It must be doubly important. But you see, heart really is central to being. Heart is central to being. I think you're aware of that. If you can ever get a hold of your heart, I think you'll be coming real close to getting a hold on your being. If you can ever come to the place where you really want, I believe that you'll genuinely become. I believe that heart is the very issue, or from the source from which our very life issues. The Proverbs writer makes the statement that we ought to take heed to our heart diligently, for out of it are the issues of life, Proverbs 4:23. And then Jesus in the book of Matthew chapter 15 and verse 19 says that out of the abundance of the heart, the mouth speaks. And then he says in verse 19, for out of the heart come evil thoughts, murder, adultery, fornication, theft, false witness, and slander. And all of this comes from the heart. So when we're talking tonight about heart, it must be that which pertains right down to the very center and core of our being. But also, heart is central to Christianity. I don't know of a way to get closer to Christianity than to talk about heart. 700 years before Jesus was born, a man, a prophet of God, Jeremiah by name, announced that there was going to be a new arrangement between God and people, a new covenant I'm going to make. And he tells some reasons and some things that would not be like, and some things that it would be like. But central and basic to all of this, there was one basic difference between the old arrangement and the new arrangement. Jeremiah said that basic difference is the fact that the new covenant will be written upon the heart. It won't be on stone. It'll be put into the person's heart, into his mind, that's where this new agreement will be struck, in the heart of the adherent. And so I would have been very disappointed and very surprised had Jesus not spent much of his time talking about heart. And he did. He spent much of his time talking about attitudes. And we find that it's central to Christianity. And it was good time. People in Jesus' day needed a new heart. They weren't much when it came, it seems, to heart. They were starved. Their hearts were shriveled. And Jesus came saying, this people draws near to me with their lips, but their heart is far from me. Matthew 15:7-8. And in the 23rd chapter of Matthew, he speaks of these people who were correct, supposedly on the outside, but inside they were corrupt. He said, you're like whited sepulchres, which outwardly appear beautiful, but inwardly are full of dead men's bones and every corrupt thing. And in Matthew, the 12th chapter, he talks about these people who were one way on the inside and another way on the outside, indicating that they had heart trouble. And he said, what is this? Either get the tree good and the fruit good, or the tree evil and the fruit evil, but stop this duplicity. And he says this and pushes us to sincerity, to genuineness, and he warns us away from duplicity and hypocrisy. What he's saying is, I want you to get your hearts right. He wasn't urging us to become evil, really, But he was urging us to be genuine. He was urging us to be sincere. And he was urging us, when it comes to the heart problem, he says, you need to correct your hearts. Consequently, any effort to maintain the external form without the internal substance is what Jesus calls hypocrisy. And yet much of our time is spent too often trying to keep up the outward form without really giving due attention to the inward substance, where the heart is, without realizing that that's really where life is. Life is where the heart is. And until we've touched the heart, we've not really touched the mainspring of life. Now, this drives me to some conclusions, and you too probably have already arrived at them. Any religion that does not reach back behind our actions and touching and motivating and remolding our attitudes is not Christianity. Let me say that again. Any religion that does not reach back behind our actions to mold and motivate and touch our attitudes really isn't Christianity. Now, you can say what you want to about it, but it just simply isn't Christianity. If my heart is not affected in the process of my being religious, if my heart isn't touched, then I've not yet come to the religion of Jesus. I've not yet come in contact with the new covenant, the new arrangement, the new agreement. And you see, I'm just simply relegated to a position that's not any better than the Pharisee and the Sadducee of Jesus' day, because they were doing things on the outside and their hearts weren't touched. Then how am I better today if all I do is what's on the outside and my heart isn't touched? Well, not any. So we're driven to the conclusion that we must be in the business of heart renovation, because the kingdom really consists of heart. That's why you can't take a little baby and sprinkle water on him at 8 days and expect that to put him into the kingdom. That hasn't got anything to do with the kingdom, because the kingdom involves heart. And an 8-day-old baby doesn't have his heart involved. He doesn't know what's going on at all. But you know, the opposite extreme is the same futility. It's futile for us to think that just because a man or a woman has been immersed in water, that necessarily makes him a Christian. That just ain't true. If his heart hasn't been touched and turned and changed, he's not a Christian any more than he ever was, in spite of the fact you baptize him 1,000 times. He's no more a Christian after the 1,000th than he was before the first. Because heart, or Christianity, involves heart. And what would eliminate the baby will eliminate the unchanged heart of the adult. Both would be eliminated from the kingdom, because the kingdom involves heart. And so we're forced to that conclusion. And I think that any effort that we spend to baptize people without first spending effort to change their hearts is to miss the message. And I lay at the door of this very problem, all the problems that are confronting the church today. All of our weaknesses, all of our inadequacies, all of our powerlessness, all of our frustrations, all of our whatever it is that may be thwarting and aborting the Christian thrust into the world, I lay right here at this door of our heart every last problem confronting us today. And if you'll think for a moment, you'll agree. And so when Jesus turns our attention and says, in the midst of all of this now, these attitudes of poverty of spirit, of mourning, of meekness, hungering and thirsting for righteousness, being merciful, all of these attitudes of mind and heart, he then says now, blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. Who are they? Who is this breed, these pure in heart people? Who are they? And what does it mean to be pure in heart? One or two things it doesn't mean. It doesn't mean sinlessness in the sense of innocence. Baby innocence is not what he means here. Something else he doesn't mean. He doesn't mean sinless perfection on the part of adults. For one reason, there aren't any people like that. John says if anybody says he doesn't sin, he's a liar. 1 John 1:8. There just aren't any sinlessly perfect people. And I don't really believe that that's what Jesus is talking about here. It certainly wouldn't exclude that, but I don't believe that that's exactly what he's talking about. There are some things that are incidental and that are secondary and that are included in this, and that would be one of them. Another one would be that of sincerity. Purity of heart would involve sincerity. Sincerity in the sense that we've already talked about, that what you are on the outside, you are on the inside. No duplicity, no irrelevance, no missing the mark, really, in that respect. He is calling us to be the same thing on the inside or the same thing on the outside as we are on the inside, or vice versa. He's calling us to that. And he wants us to be pure. But in that respect, the subculture, you know, that's among us today that we've seen come to the surface in about the last 10 years, that subculture in that respect is pure in heart, in the sense that what they are on the outside, they are on the inside. They're filthy both inside and out. And that's not an indictment against them that I'm laying upon them. They themselves claim this, and they somewhat take pride in it. And they call it letting it all hang out. And they mean by that all the corruption and the rottenness and the filthiness that's down inside them, they're just letting it be outside as well. And when you've seen the outside, you've seen the inside. Well, that's commendable in a sense. At least you're not being hypocritical. But that's not really what Jesus meant, of course, by his saying either make the tree good and the fruit good or the tree evil and the fruit evil. He's calling us to purity of heart in another way. There may be one other way that it involves, but it's not exactly what he's talking about either. And that is purity of heart in the sense of guilelessness. In Titus 1:15, the writer there says, to the pure, all things are pure. But to those that are unbelieving and disobedient, nothing is pure. Both their heart and their conscience is defiled. Now, you know what that means? I think it has reference to people being without guile, in the sense that whenever you say something to them, to the pure, all things are pure. You can tell some people something, and you know, there's no guile in them. They take what you mean. They understand it. There's no basis for suspicion and all of this. Well, I think it involves that of being pure in heart, that you're guileless. You're kind of like Neil Pryor or the man without guile, that sort of guilelessness, gentleness or childlikeness, pure in heart. I think it does involve that. But I don't think that's exactly what he's talking about. I believe that there's only one thing that really gets right to the heart of being pure in heart. And that's simply, do you love God with all your heart? I think that's what he means by saying pure in heart. Unmixed, unadulterated, total. I think he's talking here about totality of commitment. Are you really pure in heart? Like gold is pure. If it's pure gold, that means that there's no admixture of any other kind of metal in it. If you're pure in heart, I believe he's talking about a condition of spirit where God occupies the totality of our being. I think that's what he's talking about. I think later on in Matthew, the 22nd chapter, when he says that this is the very first commandment, thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart and soul and mind and strength, that's what he's talking about. And I think if you want to wrap it up in one word and go away from here tonight, it would be this: totality of commitment to God. Totality. Unmixed devotion. Unadulterated dedication. Totally and completely given to God. I think that's primarily and essentially what he's saying that this means. Blessed are the pure in heart. Well, let me say this before I forget it. I'm afraid if I wait till the end of the lesson, I'll forget it. I'd like to simply say that he's not trying to discourage us from enjoying life. And let me say that whenever a person has given himself totally to God, that he is then and only then really prepared to enjoy life to the fullest. For example, I believe that when a person has really and truly given himself totally to God, that he's then more able to love his wife, to love his children, to love his friends, to love his work. I believe he's more able to enjoy fishing and enjoy golf or tennis or enjoy strolling or enjoy whatever he does as a pastime for exercise or for recreation. I believe that only when he puts God at the center of his life do all these things take upon themselves such a luster that you just really enjoy these things to the fullest. There are two statements, and I don't know where one of them is, but Jesus made the other one, that I came that they might have life and have it more abundantly, John, the 10th chapter. And the other statement was that God has given us all good things to enjoy. I think that's involved. And that being pure in heart, being totally dedicated, completely devoted to God, doesn't have anything in the way of diminishing from the enjoyment of all the good things on earth that God has given us. No. In fact, it's only when you come to this point where you really get God at the center of your being, only then are you able to enjoy these other things to the fullest. It's the people who put these outside perimeter things in the center that don't really enjoy them even when they get them there. Because they put them in the wrong place. Life is out of focus. It's like taking a wheel and getting it out of balance. It just beats and beats and beats until finally you can't enjoy driving or anything else. But you get that thing centered and you get it all weighted just right, and it's a joy and a pleasure to be out on the highway. Well, that's kind of like life. You get God in the center and get all these other things in the proper proportion and in the proper weight, why, you just breeze down the highway of life. That's what it's all about. So I'd like to say, first of all, that it doesn't have anything to do, really, with how many hours a day you have to work to make a living. There may be some people who, because of their work load and work schedule, might think, well, now, I don't have time to be fully devoted to God. I can't be pure in heart. Oh, that doesn't have anything to do with that. Unless you've made your work your God. Unless you're a lover of money rather than a lover of God. Now, that makes it a different subject. But if you have to work 12 hours a day in order to make a living for your family, then it doesn't affect you at all. You can be a lover of God and work 12 or 14 hours a day if that's what you have to do to support your family. In fact, that's part of loving God. But if you've made your God your work and made your work your God, then you've changed gods and you're a lover of money rather than a lover of God. Or it may be, and it doesn't have anything to do really with how many times you go fishing, perhaps. It certainly doesn't have anything to do with how much you enjoy fishing. And I don't want anybody to go away from here tonight going fishing and keeping your mouth, you know, don't want to enjoy this too much. My goodness. That was like the doctors back way. There was a doctor that was called way down stream over the Netherlands one year, way in the middle of winter. And over there, you weren't supposed to skate on Sunday, on the Sabbath, they called it. And you can only skate. This doctor said, but I've got to go heal. I've got to go fix this man. He broke his leg. And I've got to go. They said, all right, go ahead and skate, but don't you enjoy it. Well, that doesn't have anything to do with whether or not you're pure in heart. Rather, there are four questions that I'd like to ask that will offer you a test and offer me a test as to whether or not we're pure in heart. And once having answered these questions, I think you can answer the question, am I pure in heart? And let me say at the very outset, I doubt that there's a person here tonight that can answer the question completely. Yes, I'm pure in heart. But may I warn you, and may I at the same time encourage you, that the pure in heart only comes after going through the experiences of being poor in spirit, of mourning, of being meek, of hungering and thirsting for righteousness, and of being merciful. Then he mentions being pure in heart. He didn't put the pure in heart first. Aren't you glad? Aren't you thankful that he didn't put poverty of spirit last and pure in heart first? Why, none of us would. We couldn't have started because we couldn't come through any door except poverty of spirit, realizing what we're not. But then he comes on up to the sixth one, and it happens to be this one of purity of heart. So it's getting on down, finely honed. It's getting on down to where the impurities are being boiled off of us, just like you boil off impurities from gold. And you don't boil gold, but what do you do with it? You put it under pressure and under fire, you know. And these impurities keep coming to the top, and the sludge and all keeps being raked away. That's kind of what happens here. As we go through one door into the next experience, we come to the point where, by the way, the impurities are being boiled away. And we come to purity of heart, singleness of devotion, oneness of dedication, unmixed in our dedication to God. The first one of these tests is this. How do I know whether I'm pure in heart? Question, what are your pleasures? What are your pleasures? What do you really enjoy doing? Deep down inside, what do you enjoy doing? For example, do you enjoy coming here on Sundays and worshiping God? If you don't, it's probably because you haven't enjoyed worshiping God the other 6 days of the week. That you haven't been involved in worshiping God hour after hour, day after day, during the week before you get here as a group. That may be one reason why you don't enjoy it here. But if you enjoy it, it's probably because it's not an unreal experience to you. You've been worshiping God all week and you've been thinking and you've been preparing your heart. Does your heart long for God? Do you ever just love to be with him and just cuddle up kind of and just love the presence of God? I'm getting older, and as you get older, evidently you wake up in the middle of the night. I don't know what the deal is. Boy, more middle-aged folks grinned at that first hour when I said, I wake up sometimes 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, you know, and just lie there wide-eyed. I used to worry about it, but I don't anymore. I've started feeling very fortunate to just be able to lie there in the quiet while everybody else in the town is asleep, and it's just me and the Lord, and I've got him all to myself. Just love to be with him. Do you find your heart gravitating toward him? Last night, or night before last, my boys and I sang at a banquet, and we sang this song, "Just a wearying for you, all the time a feeling blue, wishing for you, wondering when you'll be coming home again." You'll be coming home again. Anyway, just a wearying for you. And then the next verse says, morning comes, the birds awake. They used to sing so for your sake. Now there's sadness in the note that comes trilling from their throat. Seems they feel your absence too. Just a wearying for you. Evening comes, I miss you more. When the darkness glooms round the door. Seems just like you ought to be there to open it for me. Latch goes tinkling, thrills me through, sets me wearying for you. Oh, that's a sad refrain. It's not sad, but it's pensive, it's so expressive of somebody's longing for somebody so much so that they call it wearying for you. Just a wearying for you. Does your heart ever weary for God? Does it ever long for him like David said his heart longs for God like a young doe? Longs for water? Well, I think if you can determine where your heart is, what you really and truly like. Colossians 3 says that we ought to set our thoughts on things that are above. If you've been raised with Christ, then put your mind on things that are above, not on things on the earth. But put it where Christ is, seated at the right hand of God. Set your mind on things that are above, not on things on the earth. Do you like to worship? Do you enjoy the presence of God? How often do you think about God? Is it just occasionally to when, and some men think about God like some men think about their wives? Only when they see somebody else's wife or some other woman that maybe they wish they had rather than their own wife, and then that reminds them of their wife, and then they feel very guilty. Some people think about God perhaps like that. They only think about him when they think of something that they ought not to be thinking about, and then that reminds them of God, and so they have this constant feeling of guilt before them in their relationship with God. What do you do? Do you thrill at the reading of his word? Do you really enjoy reading the Bible? Like you'd read a love letter? That's what this book is. It's a love letter from God, telling us all about himself and all about the things he has planned for us and how he's just getting ready to be with us, and he's going to have us to come home to him, and we're going to have such a great time when we get back home. Oh, that's all in here. You see, that's just what it's about. Well, man alive, that's thrilling if you realize that it's a love letter from your father, from your best friend, from your lover. You boys ever get a letter from your girlfriend? Kind of makes you nervous, doesn't it? Boy, the old heart pounds. You know what? I've gotten many a letter from my wife when we were courting. Back before that, you know, when puppy love was in, boy, I'd get letters from this little old gal, and she'd write me 3 and 4 times a week. Then the postman just hated me. Man, he'd have to tote those things, you know, and sometimes there'd be 3 or 4 come in one mail. He thought we were crazy, but they sure did feel good to the puppy. Man, I'd just read those things, and I'd get so excited, and I'd come home for dinner, you know, from work, and I'd pick them up and eat a bite and take off back to work, and I could hardly wait till I could get by, you know, just sit down and read those letters from that sweetheart of mine. Well, that's something like this ought to be. Do you long to be with God? You know, I don't know how people could look forward to going to heaven unless they long to be with God. You ever spend any time wishing you were home with him? Now, I know those of you who are younger don't play like you do if you don't. I think it's natural that you don't spend as much time thinking about it as older people. But as you get along on down the journey and the highway, you know, becomes pretty long, and you're tired and your bones ache and you want to be on through with this thing, I think it increasingly becomes uppermost in your thinking, I want to go home. Paul had that desire. He said, I'm between a rock and a hard place. He said, I really want to go on and be with Christ. That's much better. But he said, I know it's best for you if I stay here. That's in Philippians, about the second chapter or first chapter, where he talks about wanting to go home. Well, where are your pleasures? Or what are your pleasures? What do you really enjoy doing? I think once you determine that, if you can read into your heart enough to really know what you really want, then you'll know whether or not you're pure in heart. And most of us will find that there are some unconquered places in our hearts, that he hasn't occupied all of our territory yet. But let's look again. The second test the doctor recommends is this. Where are my treasures? What are my pleasures? Where are my treasures? Now Jesus says in Matthew 6, 19 through 21, that where your treasure is, that's where your heart will be. Oh, that makes the test very simple then, doesn't it? It does. Where are your treasures? Those that you have some say about. Now there are some treasures that are going places where we don't have any say. And the amount of taxes that we're having to pay and will be increasingly increased, it's making some money be placed places where our heart really isn't. But aside from that, and aside from the soaring grocery bill, and it looks like it's going to take a good size part of our income to pay just for the groceries. Well, we could all eat less, and yet it still costs. We just eat very frugally at our house. We don't even eat fried chicken. And chicken is one of the cheapest things you can buy. But when you try to feed five teenagers and a husband and wife, even chicken is expensive. We don't even have fried chicken. But even then, we spend a lot of money on groceries. But when you get rid of the things that you don't have anything really to say about, where do you put your money that you've got left over? Where do you really invest it? Now listen, if it's in things down here on earth, in gadgets and gimmickry and in things, if that's where you put all the money that you've got, and that's where you're real thrust is and the bulk of your income, you can just count on it as sure as you're here tonight. That's where your heart is. That's right. And if it's in stocks and bonds and if it's in savings accounts and if that's where you've got your trust or if that's where you've got your money, that's where you've got your trust. And if that's where you've got the bulk of your income and the bulk of all this that's been put in earthly savings, Jesus said, well, where your treasure is, that's where your heart's going to be. So I think this is a valid test. Where are your treasures? But there's a third test, and that is, whom are you trying to please? Paul told the Galatians, if I were still trying to please men, I sure wouldn't be a servant of Jesus Christ. And he was saying that as he was, he'd just gotten beaten, and he was hurting, and he talked about how that he bore the marks of Jesus, and he said, I'll tell you what, if I were trying to please people, I wouldn't serve Jesus Christ, because they weren't compatible. Whom are you trying to please, man? You know, a man, you can tell somewhat about who he's trying to please by listening to him talk. Men are strange people. And we let the cat out of the bag by the way we talk. And you can tell whether a man is trying to please people by the way he talks around them. If he's catering to one bunch while he's with them, he'll cater to them, and that you can tell it by the way he's talking. If he's among those who are foul-mouthed, and all that, he'll talk like them. But when he comes home to see his mom and daddy or he's around the elders of the church, he's just as clean. He knows how to play both sides of that thing. You can tell whom he's trying to please if he's in his talk. Girls, you know how you can tell whom you're trying to please? By the way you dress. It's strange, and it's almost unnoticed, and you're almost unaware, I think. Maybe not. But you can tell whether you're trying to please people or God by the way you dress. If you dress immodestly, you know that you're trying to please men and you're trying to excite them and trying to be appealing to them. But if you dress modestly, it's obvious that you're not trying to please people, you're trying to please God. Those are two simple ways, and that may be oversimplifying it, and obviously it is, but it has to be reckoned with. Men, you can tell by the way you talk. Girls, you can tell by the way you dress. There are a lot of other ways perhaps too. But who are you trying to please? Paul said to the Corinthians in 2 Corinthians, the 5th chapter, in about verse 9, he said, whether at home or away, we make it our aim to please him. That was what he was trying to do. We're making our aim, he says, to please God. So if you can find out whom it is you're trying to please, you'll be able pretty well to tell where your heart is and whether or not you're pure in heart. But then finally, there's one last test, and that is, why are you living? Why are you doing what you're doing? What's the purpose of your life? Can you answer that? Jesus said, my meat is to do the will of him that sent me. And he couldn't have reduced the life force down any more probably than to talk about meat, my food. You can't live without food. He says, my food, my meat, the center of my being is to please God, to accomplish the purpose or to do the will of him that sent me. The Apostle Paul had caught that spirit from the Lord. He had caught this purity of heart that was Jesus. Jesus had unmixed devotion to do the will of God. Paul caught it also. And in the book of Acts, as he spoke to the Ephesian elders, he said, I do not hold my life to be of any value to myself. nor as precious to myself, if only I may accomplish my course and the ministry which I received from the Lord Jesus to testify to the gospel of the grace of God. So that's all I want. That's the purpose of my living. When he went and wrote to the Philippians, he makes the same statement there, and he expands on it by saying that, but whatever gain I had, I counted as loss for the sake of Christ. Indeed, I count everything as loss because of the surpassing worth of this surpassing worth of knowing Jesus Christ, my Lord. For his sake, I have suffered the loss of all things and count them as refuse in order that I may gain Christ and be found in him, not having a righteousness of my own based on law, but that which is through faith in Christ, the righteousness from God that depends on faith, that I may know him and the power of his resurrection, and may share his sufferings, becoming like him in his death, that if possible I may attain to the resurrection from the dead. Not that I've already obtained this, or am already made perfect, but I press on to make it my own, because Christ Jesus has made me his own. Brethren, I do not consider that I've made it my own, but one thing I do, forgetting what lies behind and straining forward to what lies ahead, I press on toward the goal for the prize of the upward call of God in Christ Jesus. Now, my, that expresses purpose, direction. Purpose, direction, whatever it is that life's all about. Meaning, that's Paul's meat. He had gleaned this and had sensed it from the Lord and had incorporated it to where it actually became an obsession with him, where he says, that's my purpose in living. Now, these four things, what are my pleasures? What do you really enjoy doing? Where are my treasures? Whom are you trying to please? Why are you living? I think those are four valid tests that will help us determine if we're pure in heart. Obviously, we'll all have to come away saying, well, you've missed me. Boy, I don't have it yet. And I don't want to discourage you. Paul said, I'm not yet perfect. I've not gotten there yet either. See, so we're in good company when we find ourselves saying, I'm sure not all the way there yet. Surely we're not. But let me ask you this. Is there just a spark there that you see that's real and genuine and it's growing? I know he hasn't gained all of our control of our hearts yet. I know that. He hasn't mine either. I look in my life and I see, you know, I'm not really pure in heart yet, but I also know something else. There's something in me that's living and real. And I just pray every day, Lord, take control of my whole life. I don't want to be anything but your man. Come in and take over totally. Give me your spirit completely. And you know, it's not so much of our having more and more of the spirit as it is the spirit of Christ having more and more of us. That's it. You can't compartmentalize the spirit, but we try to compartmentalize our lives. But just pray that all the unconquered parts of our hearts might be just completely explored and subjugated and subdued to where finally, one day, we'll come to the point where we say, well, thank God. Every front is secure. By his grace, we've now come to this part where we are unadulterated in our devotion. We're uncluttered in our dedication. There's no other metal there. It's pure gold. We're not ready to say that we're perfect, but at least we have now eliminated these other false gods, and no more does anyone sit on the throne of my life but the Lord Jesus Christ. Well, in closing, I want to read you a song, a poem. But someone may ask, when will I see God? If you've seen Jesus Christ, Jesus says you've already begun to see him. He says, if you've seen me, you've seen my Father. So in that respect, as we are able to see Christ, we are able to see God. But then as you see him in this creation, this beautiful creation that we live in, I see God there. I see God in the tiny baby. Those little rascals, everything about them, little tiny fingernails all manicured, and they're so perfect, you know. I can see God there. Or in a rose, or a daffodil, or in a fish. My, there's no way on earth all this could have just happened by chance. Who do you think we are to try to pawn that off on us, that all this just happened by chance? I was thinking, a horsefly got in our house tonight. Man, you'd have to dodge. He was like a B-24 bomber coming. And I just thought, good grief. Look at him. There he goes. And there's in him exactly what it takes to reproduce a million just like him. And I thought, how do you explain that? Well, either it was made or it doesn't exist. He couldn't have just happened. Well, then we're going to see him in the resurrection morning. Not everybody will want to see him. Revelation 6 says that the time will come when men will be, you know, crying out for the rocks and the mountains to fall on them, to hide them from the face of God in the presence of the Lamb. They're not all going to want to see Christ. They're not going to want to see God. But the Christian whose heart has been set on God will want to see him so bad so that when we see him like he is, we can worship him like we ought. Uncluttered by the flesh, unhindered and unhampered. Man, I long for the day when we can just sit there in full view and look at him in full array and just worship him as we ought to without any hindrance. That's the day that Harriet Beecher Stowe had in mind when she wrote this beautiful poem. Still, still with thee when purple morning breaketh, when the bird waketh and the shadows flee, fairer than morning, lovelier than the daylight, dawns the sweet consciousness, I am with thee. Alone with thee amid the mystic shadows, the solemn hush of nature newly born, alone with thee in breathless adoration, in the calm dew and freshness of the morn. When sinks the soul, subdued by toil, to slumber, its closing eyes look up to thee in prayer. Sweet the repose beneath thy wings o'ershading, but sweeter still to wake and find thee there. So shall it be at last in that bright morning, when the soul waketh and life's shadows flee. Oh, in that hour, fairer than daylight dawning, shall rise the consciousness, I am with thee. That's what's ahead of those who love God and who are looking forward to his coming. Well, if you're pure in heart, in any degree at all, if that can be talked about in degrees, and I'm thinking that it can, thank God for it, and begin to dig around and fertilize it and encourage it. Don't quench the Spirit. Encourage it. And just know that God is there, and he wants you to be attached to him so perfectly, much more than you want to be attached to him. And rather than be looking for some excuse to throw you away and cast you off, he's just there waiting and encouraging us, like the father who ran to the prodigal and fell upon his neck and kissed him much. And as he sees you digging around this little glow or this little spark of life down inside your heart, as you see you nourish it and, you know, and dig around it and fertilize it, he's so pleased. And he just more or less takes it upon himself. You're his, and he's just going to bear with you right along. Oh, well, may God bless us. Let's be pure in heart. And as we go through each of these doors into the next realm of consciousness and awareness and development, let's just thank God that he's given us such a fantastic opportunity to become like himself. Tonight, we're going to sing an invitation song of encouragement. Whatever may be your need, if it's to become a Christian, you come on and confess your faith, and we'll immerse you in water, this simple act of faith by which you're united with Christ. Or if it's to simply express as a Christian that you need some help, or if it's to simply express thanksgiving or whatever may be your need, if you want to express it publicly, you come, and we'll encourage you and assist you in it. Let's stand together.